The Guardian.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and on this week's podcast, technology editor Charles Arthur speaks with World Wide Web inventor and Olympic superstar Sir Tim Berners-Lee. We remember Bill Moggridge, inventor of the very first laptop, who died this week at the age of 69. Charles digs into the numbers behind Amazon's new Kindle. Does it have a chance in the tablet market? And we look at the latest on the UK communications data bill debate. Is it really possible for the government to track all of our online activity for the sake of national security? Keep listening to the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. First up in the news this week, a British inventor of the first laptop and founder of the global design company IDEO, Bill Moggridge, has died of cancer at the age of 69. Moggridge's Grid Compass computer was the first of its kind, a machine with a screen that folded down over the keyboard. And at the time of its release in 1982, it sold for more than $8,000. And it found an unusual home on the space shuttle. Charles, give me a bit of a context thing here. What was the technology scene like in 1982?
Well, dinosaurs walked the earth.
I remember the days.
In those days, you had things like the Compaq Portable, which was a gigantic thing, which you had to be a weightlifter, really, to make it earn the title of portable. Although, you know, they did sell pretty well. But the thing about the Grid was that whereas the Compaqs had a suitcase-like thing which you had to take apart and reassemble, in effect, the Grid came along and you just had a little thing which land out of the top, and there it was. It was all in one piece. It was a single computer which did all the job. You had sort of
But it also had its own operating system as well, whereas did Compaq have its own operating system as well?
They were using DOS.
Of course they were. So tell me a little bit more about what the Grid actually did. I mean, obviously, it wasn't whiz-bang like, you know, today's high-end laptops that you can...
It wasn't whiz-bang, but it was very rugged. It was encased in magnesium, and it was basically meant to be able to stand up to anything. So it became very popular with the US Special Forces. It's rumored that even the president's nuclear launch codes were kept on there, that, you know, if the balloon went up, then that was what they would use. The whole laptop scene at the time really wasn't as developed as it is now. Nowadays, laptops are around about two-thirds of sales of computers. In those days, they were really specialist things. You had to have lots of money. And what Moggridge did was to bring the whole idea of design, of actually the function and the form being part of each other, which is, you know, the way that laptops are now. It's very much about, you have a folding screen that comes down over the keyboard, and Microsoft sort of has almost the opposite with the Surface, where you have a screen where the keyboard folds up to it. You know, you could argue about which is which, but it's clear the keyboard is actually secondary to the screen. But the Grid, you know, nowadays it looks really clunky, but in those days it was a marvel.
What would you say Bill Moggridge's legacy is?
He really was thinking about design. He said nothing made by human beings ever has. You know, there are always design decisions made when you build something. And he really, with IDEO and everything else, he really got people to think about interaction, how function and form are intertwined, how design really matters in what you do. And, to some extent, the things that people like Jonathan Ive does at Apple, and actually what you see with a lot of the designers and all sorts of things. You know, people really think now, what is it that you want to accomplish? How do you get the design to affect that?
Yeah, it's a real kind of step in human-computer interaction, isn't it? One of the things that people talk about when it comes to Steve Jobs' legacy is that he made the technology less frightening, not more human, but certainly less intimidating. And so it seems that, you know, he took the step from Moggridge and the other pioneers in design and really push that forward to stuff that we use today.
I'm not sure Steve Jobs would ever have been able to enunciate what it was. He just knew that he liked stuff or he didn't like it. Whereas I think Moggridge gave a better framework for understanding why this thing works, that thing doesn't. Don Norman, who's a great sort of interaction designer, talks about emotional design, about getting an emotional reaction when you have something. And I think that Steve Jobs, without knowing it, without being able to enunciate, he understood the emotional aspect of design, and Bill Moggridge was really able to get into the functional and the descriptive elements of design.
Find out more at guardian.co.uk/technology. Also this week, Jeff Bezos, Amazon.com's founder, launched the Kindle Fire and the Kindle HD, or actually released these to both US and UK consumers. Two new tablets that, as you say, Charles, on the site, are more than a match for Google's Nexus 7. Why is that?
Well, first of all, they have twice the storage for the same price and the same screen size. And also the quality of the screen in terms of what the higher end ones, the Kindle HD, the 8.9 version has, that's actually higher again. And they're really pushing here, Amazon, at the limits of what can be done in terms of the price point and the quality of the screen that's being offered. It's very interesting how Amazon, which is not a company anyone thinks of as a hardware company, this will say, yeah, Kindles, well, yeah, it's just ebooks, isn't it? It's not really, they're not Asus or Acer or Lenovo or HP or any of those companies. And yet, here's a company which no one really thinks of as a hardware company coming in with a low-priced tablet, which has got really good specs.
Now, this is interesting. It's more than just an ebook reader. It is an actual tablet. Is that right?
This is an absolute tablet. It's absolutely intended to get people downloading music, downloading films, watching TV shows. Amazon here is really thinking all about the content. It is really not saying, here's a general purpose computer which you could use to write code on. That's not what they're talking about at all. They're really focusing on, and it's very clear that he wants to get the really excited people, the people who are really keen to have stuff, buying this. Because if they buy stuff, then if they buy these tablets, then they're going to buy Amazon stuff. That's profit for him.
And tell me a little bit about the marketplace. So obviously, when you look at something like the iPad, that marketplace is via iTunes. You look at the Nexus, and it's a wider marketplace. What is the Amazon marketplace? Would I be able to download, say, a single episode of a TV program? Or would I have to download the entire box set because it's via the Amazon system?
Depends a bit on the TV set, the TV series, and how the licensing works in different countries. But the thing is that Amazon is offering what it calls X-ray. So you're able to look inside books and movies and TV shows and see little extracts of them, get a flavor of them. And I think that's really interesting. They're saying, in effect, the tablet disappears, the device disappears. What they're trying to do is just be a window to content and to get people buying the content. Whereas Google is sort of trying to have it all. They're saying the Nexus 7, it's great for doing, if you've seen the advert, it's great for, it's a compass, it's a, it's an encyclopedia, it's a map, it's a this. But Amazon are very much not about that. They're very much about, this is the thing you use to consume content with.
Now, obviously, as you say, Amazon has never really been expected to be involved in the hardware market. Where do you think they're going with this? Are we going to be talking about the competition between Apple and Amazon, between Google and Amazon, in the same way that now we talk about the competition between Apple and Microsoft and to an extent Google?
In effect, now there are four players. You've got Amazon, you've got Google, you've got all the other Android tablet makers, and you've got Apple. You could sort of say you got Samsung a bit, because Samsung is actually the only viable Android tablet maker. If you look at all the other Android tablet makers, they're toast. They've got nothing that really makes them stand out. They can't offer the content that Amazon can. All they can do is be a window to the Google Play Store, which is not as good as Amazon's one and not as good as Apple's one. If you look at Samsung, they have something going for them, which is they have stuff like the Note, the 10.1, which has the pen. So there are various use cases you can make up for that. They're actually showing something interesting there. Apple has the iPad. It might, and everything that I'm hearing from my sources suggests that they will have a, quote, iPad mini October. And again, that'll be interesting to see how that's priced. Then you have Google and Amazon. Now, the contest here is interesting. You know, Google was selling the Nexus 7 at a loss through July. They priced it to retailers to make them want to have it. They priced it really low to the extent that they were taking a loss in the UK of about £30 per tablet. They pushed the prices back up so that they're making a profit in August. But the fact is still, for them, this is a break-even sort of game. You know, they're not really making any money on the hardware because they're having to pay Asus to make it. And it's questionable how much money they're going to make from people doing stuff, you know, buying content on Google Play, because that's not what Google's really about. You know, they're not actually a content company like Amazon. And then you have Amazon, who've come in with a really good product at a really good price, and they're a window into content where they make money. You know, Amazon must have made, if you think about the success of 50 Shades of Grey, which is the publishing phenomenon of the past few years, Amazon's done pretty well out of that as well, as the publisher and the author.
Mm. Yes, indeed, because people don't have to promote that they're reading it while they're on the tube.
I mean, okay, that's exactly. Now, that's only on the Kindle, and you say, well, that's not the same as a tablet. But if you start getting people buying stuff for the Kindle Fire, if they enjoy the experience, then that's a win for Amazon in a big way. And Google, with the Nexus 7, all it does is have a sort of a zero-sum product, and all the other Android tablet makers have no way to make money.
So has the Amazon Fire and Fire HD, have they been released, or was this a first trickle?
They're coming in September and October, coming in October to the UK. So you can order them, pre-order them off the Amazon store in the UK, or if in the US, you can do the same.
Okay. And finally in the news this week, peers and MPs met to hear evidence on the draft communications data bill, colloquially referred to as the snooping bill by its detractors. Charles, what does the draft bill propose?
The bill proposes that UK-based internet and phone providers will have to retain and store for 12 months the, quote, traffic data, who sent what to whom from where, of every British citizen's internet, text and mobile phone use.
And that's possible, yes or no?
Is it possible? Yes, it is, if you throw enough money on it. Should point out the move the proposal excludes the contents of messages. So it's basically just the header information. But yes, if you throw enough money at this, entirely feasible.
Well, that's interesting. The headers of information, the headers of messages can tell you quite a bit. You know, if you look at sort of network analysis, you can see clusters of people. You can, you know, you can assess similarities. You can assess what kinds of content is being passed between individuals. But then at the same time, I imagine that people would go underground. They would bury their information behind, say, false email addresses if they knew that this was coming about, or they would occlude their pathways through the web using a system like Tor or any other privacy system. So, is this actually feasible? If I know this, and I'm not particularly technologically literate.
You're a doctor.
Not this.
Well, okay. So the first point about, you know, using false emails and stuff like that. It might look as though that would work, but actually, you know, it's quite easy if you're able to trace the from and the time and link it to other use from the same IP address or location. Actually, that sort of thing doesn't really mask your identity very well, or your pseudonymity, if you prefer, you know, given that you know, your email address doesn't necessarily define you. But the other thing about using Tor and so on, well, Jimmy Wales appeared in front of the Parliament last week and said that he was confident that there'd be a general move to encryption across the internet if service providers were required to do this. That what would happen then would be that the government would have to resort to the, quote, black arts of hacking in order to break the encryption. So you'd then be left with the situation where people were sending each other message via encrypted methods, not necessarily Tor. I mean, you could just connect to websites, you know, using HTTPS, which happens already if you connect to Google. You'd find that people would, you know, basically disappear from the radar in that sense. I mean, actually, the government's already, you know, admitted that it won't be able to, you know, see what Google or Hotmail or Yahoo, if they were to, you know, if the other two were to use HTTPS or indeed Twitter. I mean, it's HTTPS to Twitter. You know, none of this is visible to the government necessarily. So, you know, some of that stuff starts to fall away. Mm-hmm. Of course, mobile phone information, texts and mobile phone calls, that stuff is much more in the clear. There's no way to encrypt that. So that sort of thing is often more useful to government and certainly to police in investigations and in trying to draw together a picture of, you know, who's in a group or, you know, what they're doing.
So who is promoting this? Is it the police? Is it that?
Police and security services, yeah. As is always the case.
And what are they saying? Why are they saying that this is interesting, necessary, feasible, possible?
Necessary to fight crime.
And the bad guys.
Well, yeah. Crime is sort of by definition done by the bad guys, I think.
It depends on whether it's white collar, blue collar, or other collar. Or, yes, fancy collar. Well, more on these stories at guardian.co.uk/technology. The father of the World Wide Web launched a brand new way of looking at the web this week. Charles, you met with Sir Tim Berners-Lee to find out more about the Web Index, web by the numbers. What is it?
Well, it's a way of looking at each country and assessing it by various measures. So how much is the web used? How much content can you access on the web? How well do the government use the web? All those sorts of things. So there's communications. There's all sorts of elements to this index. And the WWF, I think we could call it, draws these numbers together and then draws up a sort of a league table to say which countries are at the top, which countries in the middle, which are at the bottom, and it's something which they're going to be doing regularly from now on. Welcome, Sir Tim. The first ever web index reveals the impact of the web around the world. Explain to us what the purpose was before we actually get on to which countries appear where, because it's done on a country-by-country index. What's the purpose of it?
I suppose twofold. There's original purpose in a way, and the sort of the purpose going forward. Originally, when we started the World Wide Web Foundation, then we talked to a bunch of people in the field, and we looked around, so went to Africa, looked at how people were using the internet, and the common theme was that you get lots of anecdotes but no data. You get all these stories about how somebody had, a missionary finds that a guy in an African village had taught himself to translate between English and his foreign and in his own language using the Bible, and then when he got internet connectivity, he then sold his services as a translator and brought money into the village, even though the village didn't yet have running water. And so, you know, I think, well, that's very interesting. So is it right? No. So which is more important, internet or running water? And in generally, the response is, in general, we don't really have data. So what we thought, that if the Web Foundation was going to coordinate and promote work in getting humanity really to be properly served by the World Wide Web, we're going to have to go and look at the state of it. And so the Web Foundation's got quite a broad mandate, really, to make sure the web serves humanity. Then the question is, okay, what can we, with very little resources, what can we actually do? What's the most efficient thing? What if one country government comes to us and says, you know, what should we do next? Then how can we answer that question? So the Web Index came out of a general lack of data. Going forward, one of the things that I think is really important for it to do, in fact, is to put the web up there alongside vaccines and fresh water as not a luxury, actually something you need to be able to participate in the world today, and without which, you know, if you're on the wrong side of the digital divide, this is a problem, and it's in a way a growing problem, because the digital divide is getting bigger in the sense that the web is getting smarter and more sophisticated and more powerful, those who've got it, and so the gap between those who've got it and those who haven't got it is increasing.
So, I mean, it's quite a grand status for the web to put it on a par with running water and vaccines. I mean, you're the inventor of it, but is this not perhaps overstating it? You know, you can't drink the internet, so to speak.
Well, that's a great question, and in fact, the reason that when I talked about the anecdote of the missionary finding a kid who'd, you know, that wasn't, in fact, there are lots and lots of anecdotes I couldn't put any. I happened to pick one that actually a missionary actually told me, sitting on a log on a beach in on a lake in New Hampshire. And because I had put to her many, this was years back, I had put to her that it would be hubris for us to think that we should put this worldwide, you know, bring the World Wide Web thing. And she said, no, actually, that's really important. So it turns out that one of the problems is people think of the World Wide Web as a luxury because that's where it is in the, you know, in a way, that's how it came into their lives. It came into their lives initially as a really, you know, cool way of doing seeing really neat stuff like art or music or stuff online. But meanwhile, I suppose two things has happened. One is that because there's actually mobile penetration and data on mobile devices actually penetrating quite deep into Africa, it's not crazy to imagine that there will be people who have got the devices to use it. So it is actually getting in there potentially, even though there may be nothing in those languages yet, for example. So it's not a silly idea. And also what's happened is that the web has become such a part of our everyday lives that if you run a business, supposing you know you're in Africa starting a business, or you're in London starting a business, what's the difference? Well, when you start a business in London, everything happens really, really quickly. You can find people to work for you. You can check out, you can do all your market research very, very quickly on the web. Now, if you don't have the internet, then wherever you are, then you're really disadvantaged. In ways that we kind of forget. So that, yes, it's a good question whether it is, is it hubris for us to imagine that we should bring this to it? And the answer, and it was really coming to the realization that we'd been under that impression for too long that caused us really to create the Web Foundation in the first place.
So it's not quite calling the internet a human right or the web a human right. It's more saying these are really important things for living a useful modern life. You mentioned the things about the lack of statistics. I mean, there have been some statistics. I think Jeremy Hunt quoted some statistics, I think, about the OECD saying that when broadband penetration rises by 10%, you get a 1% increase in GDP. There's been similar studies with mobiles, I think, about a 10% increase of mobile penetration leads to something like a 1% increase in GDP. Do you, in putting this web index together, did you have any similar sorts of data sets to say when the web reaches 10% more people, this sort of impact happens?
Well, the web index has got lots of things in it, but really importantly, it's not just about how many wires there are. It's about is your government actually letting you use it for whatever you want? It's about is it really having an impact on health? Is it really having an impact on the way the country is run? And when you look at that, you find that it's not that these things don't all correlate. So you'll find middle-income countries, for example, who have got actually quite good internet connectivity. But given that, they, for example, haven't put any government data on the web. So the government looks completely opaque. The country doesn't have a good sense of where it is. It's more difficult to run a business because you don't have basic data about the country available. And there, so you look at some of these countries and you realize that they're kind of behind. So they ought to push forward on that. So if you like, it's, little rules of thumb, like it's good to have broadband penetration valuable, but it isn't, it would be a big mistake if that's if people just pushed for that. There are lots of other things between, it's no good just having broadband penetration. The classic one is supposing there's nothing really on the web in your language. Mm-hmm. Or supposing you're in a position to put things on the web in your language because you're in a position to blog, but you haven't realized that that is important. You haven't realized that it's valuable for you to blog about what it's like to be a person speaking your language and in your country. And you haven't, for example, put your town on the OpenStreetMap. So effectively, your village really isn't on the map. And so it's kind of hard for anybody to do business with you.
Could you just explain some of these subdivisions here then? You've got communications infrastructure, institutional infrastructure, web usage, web content, social impact, economic impact, political impact. Could you just go over those quickly and explain what you mean by each of these?
Communications infrastructure is the, you know, the thing which people naturally tend to gravitate towards. It's whether you've actually got the physical connections. To what extent have you got people wires or radio signals getting into somebody's home? There are a lot of figures out for that already, and so it's partly we've put it in there because obviously it's something that you need to make sure it's good. And in fact, for England, for such an advanced country, Britain does not, in fact, have the 95%, which you do find in Iceland, for example.
Iceland is top of the rankings.
So even though the UK is patting itself on the back for being for being second in this list, it in fact, in getting everybody online, the race online that Moth Lane Fox and others have been pushing is really important, because otherwise, until we get everybody online, then a lot of things the government will have to work using paper still, and we won't be as efficient. Companies will have to, people will have to deal with the population both on the web and with using paper, and that will be more efficient, less efficient. So communication infrastructure is just one thing. Institutional infrastructure is whether the country's laws promote the internet and also don't allow the government to possibly just go in there and spy on it or block it. We would like to have more in the index in that area. In fact, information about censorship and blocking is difficult to find in all the countries, so we could only put data in we had for all the countries which you had available. So we're hoping in future versions of the internet we have more about openness in that sense. So then moving up the scale, when content and web use is the stuff actually, is it in your language? Is it relevant? Are people using the web? So measuring, so that's that middle stripe is web, measuring whether the web is actually being used. And then the impact section, you could argue, I suppose, is the most important one, saying, are people actually using it to find a job or to have a job? Is the politics of the country running better? So the social, economic, and political impact, is it actually being used for health? Is it actually helping health? In a way, putting that in there is about, in a way, answering your first question. We're not about having the internet for the internet's sake. We're having the web as a medium of information, a humanity protected by technology, where humanity is using it for those things which are really important. The web index rises. When the women index is high, then you would hope, for example, that the Millennium Goals would be much more easy to be achieved. So in fact, we're looking at whether the web is helping towards the goals for humanity, which a lot of people have set and a lot of people feel very important.
How often are you looking to update this? How frequently will you revise it?
It's annual. So currently it's massive effort. Mm. And when it comes out again in a year, we'll have more people involved with sponsoring it and more people involved in the process of collecting it, and we'll be able to get measure more things directly, and so it's an index which will change. The composition of the index will change every year.
One thing that strikes me about it is that at the moment it's all relative. It's all, this country is number one, that country is number two, this is number three. Surely you want to have absolute measures here, don't you? That you could say that, the communications infrastructure, it used to be two, now it's five, in terms of megabits per second, say, it used to be 2 megabits, now it's 5 megabits, and everyone has, even if everyone else has moved from 5 to 10, you could say that that's an absolute improvement. Is that part of your plan as well?
Good question. I'd expect it coming from The Guardian, which is good on its nature of journalism. Yes, there are spreadsheets which have got, people tend to gravitate and dare I say it, journalists typically often gravitate towards the rankings. But yes, the absolute, if you're a country, you need to look at the absolute values. So in other words, you should not have too much chagrin if your rankings have gone just because some countries around you have done very well, you know, done very well this year. What you should look at is the absolute level. It's getting the absolute numbers up, which is what's important.
That was Charles Arthur with Sir Tim Berners-Lee. That's all for this week. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you as well to Charles in the studio and Jason Phipps, our fearless producer over in the glass box. Next Tuesday, we're back with more technology. But in the meantime, you can keep up with the latest headlines at guardian.co.uk/technology. And if you'd like to drop us a line, please do. And find out how at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. I'm Alex Kratowski. See you next week.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.